This is Rabbi G, and welcome to Harvard God and Gen Z. The goal of this podcast is to discuss life's big questions with some of America's brightest young minds. We will discuss Harvard's continued sway on the imagination as the peak of success. We will discuss how to get there and what it is like when you do. We will then shift to discuss if and in what ways meaning and God are relevant features of Gen Z. What better place than Harvard for discussing these issues with the thought leaders of tomorrow?
Okay, welcome back. We are super excited here to have an amazing guest tonight. Today, we have Charlotte Brookin. She graduated Harvard in 2019. She actually studied, majored in religious thought, wrote a thesis on Shabbat, I believe, which you'll tell us about, hopefully. She's now married and living in LA. Welcome, Charlotte.
Thank you for having me.
So let's just start a little bit with, tell us a little bit of how you are. Where did you grow up? What part of the country? What kind of family did you grow up in? Was it a family that was a religious family, non-religious family?
So I grew up in Brooklyn Heights, which is a very artistic enclave of New York City. I'd say the way I describe my neighborhood is that it's 50% artists and 50% people who work on Wall Street who wish they were artists. And so it's like a very, like the first school in the country that had no grades was started around the block for me. So it's like a very unconventional, more liberal kind of neighborhood. Grew up in a family that was religious. We went to a Reform temple, but I didn't, not that there's anything wrong with my temple. I definitely enjoyed going there. I have my best friends in the world are still from Hebrew school, but it didn't really fulfill that spiritual itch that I had always growing up. I feel like I always had so many questions that were left unanswered.
Questions that you asked so you were just born with this itch as long as you could remember. What was your first question growing up? What was something that bothered you as a kid?
I think I definitely always felt that there was something greater out there. It's interesting that the concept of, I'm not going to pronounce it correctly, but hitbedut, I want to say, that kind of meditation that you do when you're alone and you talk
about hitbedut.
Yeah, hitbedut, exactly. That's something I feel like when I read about it, I was kind of shocked because I'd already
been your whole life
from a very young age. Okay. Yeah, like lying in bed at night, looking out my window. I never felt like I was alone per se, if that makes any sense.
You always felt there must be something out there, and it wasn't necessarily, it was a feeling, intellectual, or just kind of, it just made sense. Something else has to give rise to a world like that we live in, or what would you describe?
Feeling in my gut, definitely a feeling in my gut that I probably intellectualized myself out of as I got older, especially because I grew up in a community where believing in God was seen as very regressive and it was trendy to be doubtful. But at the same time, I did always feel like there was, especially when I was alone, it's something I can connect with more, and in nature. And I spent a lot of time growing up in nature. We'd always go out to the country, me and my family, and just like being in trees and going on hikes. And in those moments, I definitely always felt that there was something greater than myself that was looking out for me and that connected all things, as corny as that might sound. It's just a feeling I always had in my stomach. So
like our forefather Abraham at a young age, 3 years old, had this feeling that there must be more to life. So you're in good company, Charlotte. That was very good company. And your parents, you were open with them about your thoughts on it? They agreed with you? It was just a subject that they didn't touch very much?
They never pushed me either. Like when I was a good student in Hebrew school, and they were very proud of that. They always pushed me to accomplish whatever I wanted to, but they also didn't force any beliefs on me. It wasn't like if I didn't think this or feel that, then it was wrong. And I mean, it was probably something I kept more private until recently, probably because I just didn't have the language. And I didn't even know how to describe what I was feeling. And I also think definitely in my earlier teen years, I was very, even if I had these senses within me, I very much intellectually wanted no part of it, just because I again felt like
embarrassed by it, or it was so out of step with the community you grew up in, or
I'd say it was something that more around the ages of like 11, 12, 13 I became more embarrassed by that. It didn't bother me as much when I was younger, but I just saw so many of my peers who I considered smart, just, and not just peers, actually, probably, you know, people like Bill Maher, right? When you're growing up and like these people on are just seen as idols, and you learn in school about the Enlightenment and how the movement away from religion enabled science. And then you piece together all of these things, and there's a whole picture of the world where anything that's religious is inherently regressive. And so I didn't see, no one had ever shown me how science and religion could be compatible, probably because I never learned about religion in a very sophisticated way until studying with you and in college. And so,
it was a belief you felt was not compatible, but with the culture, with where the world has gone.
And it I almost separated the feeling I had in my gut from learning, like, the world was created in 7 days. And then that seemed, oh, well, of course not, the Big Bang. And like in physics class, we learned about the Big Bang. And so how could that be possible? And like, that's such a stupid idea. That's just what people came up with when they didn't know any better. But then at the same time, I couldn't reconcile that with this feeling of some kind of a greater spirituality. And also feeling that those who lacked that inner sense were very nihilistic and dark people, that it was something I was not attracted to, as just in terms of how those people viewed the world.
Right.
And so I found myself distancing myself from that more and more and more. But then in that sense, I was isolated because I also, whatever, I'm very academic, and I would hate to think that I'm suddenly some anti-intellectual. So
it was, well, lots of different pushes and pulls, but let's get into that a little bit. So you did end up at Harvard at a certain point. And did you find that that nihilism at Harvard was particularly prevalent? Is that the winning ideology nowadays?
Yeah. I mean, to me, I felt like, but you know what? I don't think it's anyone's fault. I think it's just that, unfortunately, myself included, I just think we've taken off so many stops. And I think people in my generation are like a train running off the tracks a little bit. People just don't have a very clear path and direction, probably since, I don't know, the 60s, 70s. And that's not to say that what was in place in the 50s in America was necessarily like the quote unquote right set of morals and values, or that there weren't things that could have been changed. But at the same time, I think the amount of freedom we've been given, also because of technology, like, no one likes to acknowledge this, but we talk about, you know, casual sex is a value, but it's not a value. It's just that, like, we now have the birth control pill. And so that's less a function of values. It's more a function of science.
We can do it now, so why not?
Yeah, exactly. And kind of not, it's interesting because we talk all about the mind-body link, but I find people doing things that make them unhappy all the time.
What are some of those things that you notice in college that make people less fulfilled, less happy?
I think people prioritized status at Harvard, which is unsurprising, because to go to a place like Harvard, you have to somewhat value your academic status. But I think as much as it is good to value your academic achievement, I think thinking about status in every single arena in life is very unhealthy. And I just found people being just as competitive outside of the classroom as they were inside the classroom. And I don't know, as competitive as I am, I'm not competitive with friends. And right. I don't like to become, if I'm truly interested in something, it's because I'm interested in it and I want to learn about it, not for the sake of beating someone else. And so I think it created this general feeling of a rat race. And I mean, the final clubs are very controversial. It's become political at this point. It's way beyond.
Explain, what are those final clubs?
It's like sororities and fraternities, and kids just have to be different. So
they'd be different, right? Let's call it something, just Harvard, right?
I mean, you can go Google it. And at this point, there's so much written that's very political about gender equality and race. And my point is much less about that. It's just that, you know, this need for groups that only 10% of the class can be in. Whereas I had friends at Princeton and at Yale, which are comparable schools, and they just had a very different experience socially with groups and clubs. And even like getting into something like the Harvard Crimson is like a whole process and ordeal. Not that there shouldn't be standards, but just that it sometimes feels like the standards extend far beyond your performance. And it also just becomes about social performance.
But do you think this nihilism or this need for status is in some way tied to the fact that people have lost other forms of meaning
or are
on this nihilistic track, and that's why they need to cling to something else to create, you know, feeling good, I guess, or
feeling
like a certain meaning. Oh, my meaning is my status. Is that, do you think it's directly correlated?
Yeah, I do. I definitely think a good way to think about it is like, you get to put on a name tag and you're very safe in that name tag of I'm a this or I do that. And it feels very good because you're safe and you're secure and there's some kind of a broader institution putting you into a role. And so like in the worst form of religion, right, which is like heavily institutionalized, also more about status than about prayer, it's also obsessed with different rankings and places that you can reach in the organization. And I think bureaucracy in general is very nihilistic. And it just feels like Harvard is like obsessed with creating different titles and bureaucracies. Like you're already at Harvard. Like, do you really need like a more exclusive
sure.
Once you're already in Harvard? It's just so crazy. And
it never ends at the end of the day. There's always room for more status, more the next.
Exactly. Like I hate any kind of like bureaucratic climbing up the ladder. And it just feels like everything at Harvard is like that. And there's no room for like real freedom. Like, I don't see how someone like Elon Musk, for example, would have succeeded at Harvard in the sense that other kids view success in terms of getting titles. Because if you're building something new, then you're not getting a title. You're creating something yourself and you don't have that accredited institutional.
You're saying it stifles creativity in a certain way. People aren't
risk-takers. I definitely think so, yeah. And there's also like a very specific set of guardrails of like what institutions you can be a part of. Like, just speaking personally, like when I got engaged, that's also an institution, but there was definitely a lot of shock on the part of my classmates because I was one of very few people in my year to be engaged before we graduated. And I mean, I'm very happy in my decision. I don't think anyone wished me ill, but I'm just pointing out that
that's not the standard track for a Harvard.
It's not the standard. Exactly. Like it's definitely not something that you hear is recommended. And I just find it interesting that there's, in the same way that probably in the 50s, it was very conventional for women to get just like be pushed to get married while in college, but not to enter other kinds of roles in the workforce or in other academic institutions. I just wish people would think a little bit more critically about how we're just as narrow-minded about those same things. It's just that they flipped.
Sure.
So it's not really that people have, in my
mind, a new role for women. It's equally expected that they have to succeed, like given the opportunities, and succeed almost like a man in the old days would succeed, so to speak.
Yeah, in some sense, and just that I think being forced to do anything in a way that makes you really fundamentally unhappy, of course, is bad. But I just wish people would look a little bit more critically when they think that they're so free thinking in what they're doing.
Sure.
Like I don't necessarily see not to parrot excellent sheep, but I don't necessarily see that Harvard.
Sure.
I mean, for better or for worse.
And how many people were like you, Charlotte? You know, you were obviously not the normal student in Harvard. You were, so to speak, from the beginning, kind of had an affinity for spirituality, realized status wasn't all that. I mean, how unique are you? How many, or do you think there is a whole class of people like you that kind of see through the status seeking, kind of do have an intuitive, perhaps, belief in something else? There's got to be more to life than what we see. And then maybe they just are either scared or just don't have the vocabulary to talk about it. Do you think there's an underculture that's there, or do you think you're just one of the few and the proud, and that people just really are not connected at all?
Yeah, look, I don't want to, it's not like when I got to campus, wasn't also interested in the same status games. Like, I think it's hard when you are in a new place and you're grappling to figure it out that you're going to get caught up in stuff. I don't want to speak like I'm, you know, somehow morally superior. And I think there's definitely people who cast doubt on how valuable all these, I don't think I'm alone. I don't want to speak for anyone else's experience. I know some people very much, at least in the moment, enjoyed what those institutions gave them. I mean, how fulfilled they are now, I don't know. Like, I'm just not in touch. So it's like hard for me to speak to it. Like I only know the path that I carved for myself, but I think something where it's like, clearly, like I was a little bit off the beaten path is like, I did study religion. I was only one of 13 kids my year. Whereas most
of your, how did you come to that? Why did you decide to study religion?
Because, you know, I love the humanities, but it was, everything was very politicized, which I didn't really like. And yeah. I liked that religion was kind of in its own little bubble where, like, for my favorite teacher in the Divinity School, Kevin Madigan, who is a specialist in medieval Christianity, but also in the role of the church in the Holocaust and in Jewish-Christian relations. He is just so brilliant. And it's so clear that the way he thinks about history in the world is so beyond just our political fights of today. And I found it frustrating that sometimes in other departments, people couldn't look at history beyond the way that we like to think about current events now. And, you know, just having a different lens through which to look at different texts and different things and focus on different themes, it was just...
So in an odd turn of events, you're saying the religion department in Harvard may have been the most open-minded and kind of questioning the paradigms that were fed and looking at the world in a kind of a different way than everybody else.
Yeah, I felt that. I loved the Divinity School. I not to say that there weren't great professors. Like, look, I also am not STEM person. And so for all I know, the math department could be the same or you know, bioengineering. I have no idea. I'm just saying between like history and English and I don't know. I can't even remember. There were a few other concentrations I was considering. I just felt like I was going to do NELC maybe, Near Eastern Languages and Civilizations. Okay. And that was just so, outside of a few professors, I felt like the department itself had become so politicized over issues like Israel-Palestine. And not that those aren't important issues, but I kind of wanted to learn about things that preceded even the thought of those kinds of issues. And like looking back at history through the lens of things that are happening now just was not appealing to me. I just wanted to look at things for what they were in the moment that they were being discussed.
And so what was your thesis about?
I wrote my thesis about Shabbat, and I basically took Abraham Joshua Heschel's book, The Sabbath, and I looked at how he talked about space and time, and I decided to define our digital technology as another dimension of space, kind of like a fourth dimension. And so calling for an additional, even stronger need for Shabbat in the sense that the digital dimension has all the aspects that are tantalizing about the physical dimension in terms of talking about our senses and access to new information at a very fast rate and, you know, a little bit more hedonistic pleasure that like you can step away pleasure insofar as it's about acquisitiveness and getting more and more and more. That's something that's just very, very easily accessible in the digital dimension. And so it increases our need for some kind of a Sabbath, even if it's not in the strict Jewish sense, just generally speaking, time for people to be off of their phones devices. And technology. Sure.
Reflective mood.
Yeah, exactly. And that's something that many people talk about, a digital detox. So it's not like it's my original idea, but just framing it in terms of...
You're saying Sabbath in some ways has more importance than ever before in our day and age.
Yeah, I definitely think so. In many different respects. I mean, I think like distraction is a huge problem. I know for myself, I'm very much just as guilty of it. I think also self-censorship. Just because something that we're offered in time is a chance to learn from our mistakes and to transform. Like you can't, transformation isn't a physical process. It's physical, but it happens in time. And when all you're offered is a 6-second video and then suddenly everyone's judging you and you just don't have that chance to, you know, step back and like reevaluate yourself. it's just like, I do think like, I'm not surprised about cancel culture, and it's not just like a left or a right thing. I just think like the nature of how the digital world works makes it very hard to offer people a chance to explain themselves further, rectify any decisions, because you literally have 6 seconds of someone's attention and then that's it. And then they make the decision. And so
there's no depth. There's no depth. There's no pausing, time for reflection, et cetera. So it's hard to actually have a real genuine conversation about anything. So yeah, totally understand that. Now tell me a little bit about, do you believe that, you know, again, you mentioned this ideal of nihilism. Where do you think this ends? Do you think people will come back and realize this lack of spirituality in their lives? Or do you think, or more than that, how would you, you've kind of, again, always had this intuition. It seems that it's added a lot to your life. How would you explain to people? What would be your language of, hey, this is important, this is something you would explore. How would you explain it to someone else in your generation?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that got me past thinking religion is quote unquote dumb, that I think a lot of people have hangups about, is when you start to think about God and you start to think about all of the new discoveries we've made in, let's say, quantum mechanics, right? If God created the universe, God knows about quantum mechanics. So there's one way to look at things, which is that God has a certain set of knowledge, and that knowledge is recorded in the Bible. And then as human beings, we're surpassing God's knowledge. Or it's that we had a limited understanding of how the universe works. And at the time that we received information, it was given to us in a way that we could understand. But since our depth of knowledge throughout history has progressed, the same knowledge is still true, but it's just that we now understand it in new, like in a new mathematical language, let's say, or in terms of physics. And it was always there to begin with, and right. God always knew it, but it's just that we're just stumbling upon it now. Mm. And when you look at scientific discovery as getting closer and closer to our source code that God inevitably knows, then you can feel much more comfortable about, and it reinvigorates science, because it's the mission for understanding us, for our purpose. It's such a beautiful way to look at science. And to me, it's not shocking when you learn that the early scientists were monks. When it's discovery framed as discovery to understand God's creation, what is more inspiring than that?
And sure. So you're saying this whole false dichotomy between you have to choose science or religion is wrong. And reality, in many ways, they're on the same mission and are very much compatible. And so this kind of what people think, you have to choose either being intellectual or being a regressive religious person, that whole concept is not true.
Yeah, I think that's what leads to the nihilism, because then what are you doing science for? What, to become more beautiful, to live longer? Like it's just kind of depressing. Like when you think about, oh, I'm just building an iPhone so that I can just get more and more dopamine hits. And like, that's why I want to work at Apple and improve the next iPhone. That's so sad. Like, how can you not become a little bit nihilistic? But when you think about, and whatever, as corny as this sounds, but using technology to understand ourselves better and to thus improve human life, but human life as something sacred, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's such a more, it's much more optimistic way to look at our endeavors. And then I think it's not necessarily nihilism that leads us to do nothing. It's nihilism that leads us to do things that are not good for us. And I feel like the 20th century and like the awful wars of the 20th century speak to that, because it's like, what are you worshiping? Like, what's the end of like all of this science, right? Like Yuval Harari said this really well, and it's harsh and blunt, but it's true. I believe he said it, which is that you can build a train track across the country, or you can build a train track to Auschwitz, right? Like technology has to be directed for some kind of an end. And so to me, the key of making sure that our technology isn't used for evil is to avoid the nihilism that's offered when you just don't have like God in the picture at all. Also, I mean, another way to look at religion that to me also makes sense and that I think would be helpful for people to think about is just, I love using this example. Like, let's say the phrase, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. That's something that's true emotionally. Everyone kind of knows that and acknowledges that, but it's also true physically. Like fasting is extremely successful as a tool for improving your health. as is weightlifting. You're making yourself weaker and weaker in the process of making yourself stronger. And if that's true on a biological level, it means it must also be true on a physical level. Like when we do talk about like the laws of physics, we're all governed by the laws of physics. Like it's not something we think about in our everyday life, but that's now a thread that's taken you from your emotional state to your body, to like the very way our universe works. I'm sure that some physicists can explain what I'm saying in a way that makes more sense, because I don't have the background to explain it. But if you think about God as the thread that connects with, as the needle that connects the thread of all three of those things, and we all intuitively can sense, if we're building from the ground up, if physics is what governs our body, which is what governs our mind, there has to be some kind of a unity. And so the idea that there's a unity scientifically, if we look at the fields of physics, biology, and psychology, makes a lot of sense. And so if you're looking at like the laws of science, how in some way could that not be God? Like when we talk about God being the realm, that God being that which unites the physical and the spiritual. To me, that's the most obvious presentation of that. And so I just feel like the more I learn about what God is in a sophisticated way, and not just like a man in the sky, then it becomes clear to me that everything can be a religious endeavor if you want it to be. It's just that we choose to say certain things are incompatible with religion, but that's because we're not giving religion its due, if that makes any sense.
Right. So you're saying, in other words, that it's that if we see everything as unified and recognize that both the amazing equations of physics and the intelligence behind it, and that there's so much order and beauty in the world, to say that's something else is ludicrous. That it only makes sense if we say that all of that is leading towards something bigger, and something bigger than ourselves, and something cosmic, and something.
Yeah, look, I have no I don't know. It's just, to me, when I look at the fact that there's, how can there be, how can there be such order randomly? It just doesn't make sense to me. Like I just think, like when you, just as we learn more and more about science and about how much order, because science is just discovering order, right? Like,
sure, exactly.
Laws. It's not like, if anything, the world seemed like a less religious place before, because it seemed like everything was random. But when you learn how not random everything is, how can you not see God everywhere?
100%. Right? That's exactly what Maimonides says. This exactly, that before you learn metaphysics, you have to learn physics. You have to first see order in our world, and then you'll see the order in the higher world. But there's no question that order down here naturally leads to understanding the bigger reality kind of beyond. So there's no question about it. They shouldn't be seen as two separate vehicles. You mentioned one thing also. When you said the word sacred, can you define that for us? When you say that religion leads towards, instead of dopamine hits, towards something sacred, what's an example of something sacred in your mind? Or what's meaningful, perhaps, in your mind?
Yeah, I mean, this is like a William James question. Like, what is the sacred? I mean, I think to me, what's sacred is that which, if you went 5,000 years ago or 5,000 years forward, it's the things that, unless we really, I don't know, I'm sure someone can pick this apart, because there's things that happened 5,000 years ago that are awful, and maybe they'll happen in the future, and maybe it's good if they change. But things like family and trees and the sky being blue, like these are things that are, they have a rhythm of creation and recreation in our world and their own symbiosis. And kind of in the same sense, and I think even like human health is sacred, right? Like I think living, I don't know, maybe living things is a good way to think about what's sacred. I do, life is sacred. Very original. But I would say that those things are sacred. I think also you kind of know for each for himself what things are sacred, because the thought of not having those things, I don't know. You could also say that people love awful things, and the thought of not having those awful things makes them very sad. I guess I'd say it's the things that
God, it sounds like one thing you're saying is that things that last beyond the moment.
Yeah, I would say that. External
aspects, something that lasts beyond the moment.
Yes.
Not just an in-the-moment pleasure that just you have one day. And then, you know, so many foodies nowadays that, you know, food is the ultimate of you know, the first, only the first or second bite's even that great. By the third, fourth bite, you're like, okay, it's just another piece of food. It's out of your system completely within 24 to 48 hours. There's nothing more temporary than that. And we spend so much time and money, you know, arranging whole entire vacations around what are we going to eat? Where are we going to go? And obviously I would say that that might be the extreme, the opposite. And maybe sacred is that those things that are eternal, that touch upon a point that, that lasts forever, that creating connection and bond and whatnot. But I don't want to.
Yeah, I definitely think that's true. I think it's the things that last beyond the moment. Definitely. It's those things that are there can always turn back to for better or for worse. I mean, family, nature, loved ones.
Right.
It's very universal.
Yeah. And our society nowadays, the advertising world has got a hold of that and tried to, every second should be a new thought, a new advertisement, a new thing. And it's very hard to tap into that bit of the eternal, which also I think what you're saying is those little moments of eternality are actually moments where we're connecting to the eternal by having those more eternal moments. And that's what creates a meaningful life is that bridge. And unfortunately, it's so hard to find that nowadays.
I definitely think, by the way, people in the quote unquote secular, like post-religious communities in San Francisco, they're very much becoming aware of this fact, right? Because you're seeing this whole birth of interest in psychedelics. You're seeing the rise of people like Naval Ravikant, who talks all the time about the need for meditation, for solitude. I mean, Naval Ravikant, all but in name, is an extremely religious thinker. I mean, the way he frames what's valuable in life for the tech world at large is very much compatible with the way that more spiritual people think. And I don't doubt that there's definitely some kind of a push-pull where when we get too far away from these things, we inevitably find ourselves returning to them. And so, I mean, on the whole, I'm an optimist. I mean, am I an optimist that it's going to all happen tomorrow? No, like probably not. But I think if we think beyond like, you know, the immediate and even our lifetime, I do think that, you know, anything is possible.
Sure.
I believe that.
I agree. Some people are saying that Generation Z is that generation that might kind of be that snapping back a little bit, searching for that meaning that may have been lost, as you said, in the 60s and 70s for that freedom or whatever you want to call it. And I think that lack now of that deeper connection is being realized, especially nowadays in our quarantine state. It's much easier to kind of hear that still quiet voice inside all of us that wants that deeper connection.
Yeah.
Maybe intuitively knows it's there.
Yeah. It's interesting because the 60s, 70s, like at the same time, it was a much more spiritual time than like the 50s were. And so like, look, there's something to be learned from every age, but I guess the beauty that I think Gen Z could offer is some kind of a synthesis of like the spirituality and the unconventional creativity of the 60s, 70s, but also keeping that in harmony with the traditions and values that without which we can't even succeed creatively. Like Jocko Willink loves to say, and maybe it's Joe Rogan, one of them, I love them both, that discipline equals freedom. And I feel like that's a value that I think I see people in my generation coming back to just as they're kind of learning it on their own. And so I think it's definitely, it's possible because you can't even have the freedom to be creative if you don't have a certain degree of discipline to like sit down and do what you need to do, so.
Beautifully said. Well, thank you so much, Charlotte, for your thoughts on what's going on and the culture and where God has left today. And we hope you'll be a pioneer in spreading these thoughts that meaning is important and still so relevant today, maybe more relevant than ever before. So thank you so much for your time. It was great to chat.
Thank you very much.